Welcome back. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On June 17th, Columbus police officers arrested four people who were part of a group protesting the recent acquittal of a Minnesota officer who shot and killed Philando Castile last year. The protesters also wanted to raise awareness about, among other things, what they believe is an exclusionary atmosphere at Pride festivals and in LGBT organizations. Coming up, we'll hear from a representative of Black, Queer, and Intersectional Columbus. Joining us now is Columbus Police Chief Kim Jacobs. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The chairman of the Stonewall Columbus Board of Trustees issued a statement late last week, calling on the city police and the Franklin County Sheriff's Office to formally review what occurred during the protests. How have you responded?
Well, I informed Stonewall, first of all, that I would like to sit down and meet with them, and we intend to do that. Also, it isn't required for anybody to ask us to review what we do in an incident like that. We have automatic investigatory procedures every time we use force. We always do an after action after any event such as this, just to analyze what worked, what didn't work, and go back over that so we can plan for the next time. And we always investigate any citizen complaints that we have. So we're in communication with Stonewall, and we're going to be doing the investigations that we normally would do.
Black Queer Columbus has said that Columbus police assaulted the protesters with bicycles and mace, that they jumped on, pushed, pummeled, and chased them with horses as well. They said that four black protesters were targeted. A lot of people are looking at just at that one video. That's only just a little bit of the time that that the event occurred. What are your impressions of what happened?
Well, certainly there's a lot of video available to us, and we'll be analyzing as much as we can get our hands on. We were recording. We had our officers at the scene with cameras. We had a number of them wearing body cameras. Okay. Any video that we get from people that were using their cell phones is going to be looked at with regard to the investigations of the use of force and the complaints that we received.
A lot of video that we get these days doesn't have sound. Is there going to be sound associated with it?
It depends on what type of video it is. With our body cameras, there is a look back, so we can look back 60 seconds for visual, but if it was just turned on, then it doesn't record audio for that first 60 seconds back. But as soon as it's turned on, it starts recording the audio. So from that point on, we would have audio from our body cameras. But if it's a cell phone video, there might be audio depending on how close the person with the camera was to the people that were actually saying something. With our GoPro video cameras, then we would have audio again, but it still depends on how close you were to the person that you were trying to hear.
Black Queer Columbus has said that the protesters were held in a Columbus police van for 4 hours before processing and without being provided medical attention. Is that typical? What do you know about that?
I don't know that that is true, but all of our wagons are recorded. So we have a backseat camera in all of our cruisers. We have cameras in the rear of our PTVs. Mm-hmm. So all of that is recorded, and that would be analyzed as well. It is not necessarily I can't imagine that somebody that needed medical wouldn't have been given medical, but if that request was made and it's recorded and we didn't provide that, we would certainly take action on that. But medical was available throughout, and 4 hours would be a long time to be in the back of a paddy wagon. Generally, people that are arrested are going to be processed through our ID section and then taken to jail.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Coming up later, we're going to talk about this identity crisis within the LGBT community. It's been going on for a long time. My guest right now is Columbus Police Chief Kim Jacobs. We're talking about what occurred at the Stonewall Pride Parade on June 17th. Coming up, we're going to hear from a spokesperson for Black Queer Columbus, the group behind the protest at the parade on June 17th. Chief, the history of the Stonewall Pride marches reaches back to a time when police were very much the enemy of the LGBT community, particularly the trans community. How are officers who work with the parades these days made to be aware of that history and its relevance?
Well, we have diversity training that begins with our recruits in the academy. State mandates a community diversity class, and then we double the time that we spend on training our officers right from the get-go on our diversity in our community and how to deal effectively with people. But at the bottom line, we require people to follow our core values, which are professionalism, respect, integrity, discipline, enthusiasm. So everyone gets treated with respect. The Division of Police has come a very long ways with regard to how we handle our LGBT community. We had more officers volunteer to work this parade this year than we've had in the past. And that's because they enjoy being in this crowd of people that are so appreciative of our response. Last year after the Pulse nightmare,
In Orlando, really, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Stonewall was rightfully very concerned. It was just days within that massacre. And, you know, we stepped up and added more on-duty resources. And this year, officers that were told about last year's response volunteered. Our officers enjoy working festivals and parades like this because it's such a happy time. People are very appreciative of our support. The police, as you said, have not always been on the right side of civil rights, but here in Columbus, I believe that we've come taken tremendous strides to make sure that we are on the right side of civil rights issues. We protect the First Amendment, and everybody's right to use it.
Protesters supporting Black, queer, and intersectional Columbus also gathered the following day at the county jail, and among other things, they were concerned about how the four people who had been arrested have been treated during their incarceration. What is the policy for transgender people when it comes to housing after being arrested?
Well, it is managed by the sheriff's office, so mm-hmm. I can't tell you what the exact policy is, but I was told that we have a jail here run by the sheriff's office that does have a policy, unlike many other facilities. So I believe that Stonewall took strides to ensure that they were being treated appropriately. And, you know, that would be something that the sheriff's office could probably better respond to.
And just before I let you go, one quick question. Did the organization that held the protests, did Black Queer Columbus notify anybody that they were going to do that protest, to have that event there?
According to my incident commander, they did not make contact with us to tell us what their intentions were. And so we had no knowledge that this was going to happen other than the understanding that the parade in Washington, D.C., you know, days before had been interrupted as well.
Okay. Columbus Police Chief Kim Jacobs, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ann.
That's Columbus Police Chief Kim Jacobs. Appreciate her joining us today. Joining us now is Ariana Steele. She's a spokesperson for Black Queer Columbus, the group behind the protest at the Stonewall Columbus Pride Parade on June 17th. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
I just asked the chief if they were informed of this protest within the parade. Did you inform Stonewall that you were going to do this?
So I wasn't directly part of the original protest on the 17th at Pride Parade, and my organization, Black, Queer, and Intersectional Columbus, did not help in planning this. We've actually been reacting to it, and we were the people who planned the action outside of the courthouse on Monday. So I can't really speak to what happened before then.
How was, I guess this gets to the issue of what then Black, Queer, Intersectional Columbus is protesting at this point. It doesn't have anything to do with the protest at the parade, right?
It's
about the arrest.
It's about the arrest.
Okay. Why?
We find that the violence that happened on the four protesters, in addition to other people who were protesting on that Saturday, was too much on the hands of the police and seemed to be instigated on the hands of the police when it was just a group of peaceful protesters there.
What were you, what instead would you expect the response to be?
Well, I would prefer the response to be the police to look at the situation, recognize that there was no immediate danger or violence coming from the 10 people stood there silently with tape over their mouths, and assess it from there and not use force.
The protest was to hold space for Black and brown, queer and trans people. That's according to a press release that was put out by your organization, right, on mm-hmm. June 18th. So if you don't know what they were doing and you weren't part of that protest per se, how do you speak then for what the protest was being held for?
Right. So I have been in contact with the people who were protesting the whole time since Saturday after the arrests. I was kind of put in this position to work on protests after the fact and kind of help represent people. And so I've kind of become like a spokesperson. And I've spoken to everyone in the protest quite a bit.
My guest is Ariana Steele. She's a spokesperson for Black Queer Columbus. That's a group representing, but it was not behind the protest at Stonewall Columbus Pride Parade on June 17th, but they are now representing the four folks who were arrested and held overnight in the Franklin County Jail. Stonewall has requested a formal review of police and sheriff's office of the police treatment and the sheriff's office treatment about what occurred in conjunction with the protest and afterward the incarceration. Are you satisfied with that? What is your response to that?
So we did put out a statement asking Stonewall to do that, but we haven't heard back from Stonewall that they are doing that. And I'm not sure where that information is coming from.
It was put out on a public release.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is something that we'd like. We'd also really like Stonewall to call for the Department of Justice to do a review of the Columbus Police Department and the violence on people of color.
Why the Department of Justice?
It seems that a Department of Justice review may be more thorough than an internal review.
And why that level of review?
Columbus, this isn't the first time the Columbus Police Department has done unnecessary violence on Black and brown people of color. There are many, just a couple of days after the arrests on Saturday, there was someone who was shot at by a police officer in the Columbus Police Department. So I think that this review is very much needed, and this issue is kind of just shining light on the need to review the violence.
And it's more about race than anything?
I'd say so.
Stonewall has said that it's heard your concerns and is ready to participate in constructive dialogue that results in real change. Now, once again, I just want to separate the Black Queer Intersectional Columbus from the group that actually did the protests. Mm-hmm. Tell me about what Black Queer Intersectional Columbus's view is of Stonewall and how it embraces or not people of color in the organization.
Well, so Stonewall takes their name, as you might have mentioned, from the Stonewall riots that were instigated by queer and trans people of color against the police due to police violence on them. So one would expect Stonewall to represent people of color and make sure that they're safe. But how we see it is that by Stonewall, one, allowing a large police presence at their fest, at their pride parade, in addition to not outwardly and publicly condemning the violence on the hands of the police onto the protesters, it shows that they don't really care for their full community, including people of color.
It's a really big event now. I remember back when it wasn't so big, when it was actually more threatening to be in the parade than not. And there's police presence at any gathering that large. Why should Stonewall's celebration be any different?
Well, there are alternatives to having a large police presence. We have heard that the police were trained on de-escalation techniques, but it doesn't seem that they use these techniques on the protesters. There are other alternatives, such as private and community-based security, who are trained thoroughly in these techniques and are aware of racial bias. So those are some other options.
You mean instead of official law enforcement?
Yes.
What are your next steps? What's happening next?
So now we're really working on DeAndre's case, since they're being treated with a felony for something that we don't think that they did. Right now we are making sure, hoping and pushing for them to not get indicted. Since DeAndre came here to Columbus on a research program, they're here primarily as a scholar.
From Emory University,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so they're here on an 8-week research program called the Summer Research Opportunities Program, which is meant to give students of color the opportunity to get to know what graduate-level research is like and do their own independent research. So DeAndre has also been accepted to study abroad in the fall and finish their senior year and graduate from Emory in the spring. So I just want to show that an indictment would really harm DeAndre as a scholar, academic, and in their career. So we're working on kind of just having the best outcome for them so that they can continue on with their academic career.
DeAndre Miles, 21-year-old from Atlanta, is accused of trying to take an officer's gun.
That's true. I can't speak for what happened since I wasn't there, and
right.
I'm not DeAndre. But as I said, I can speak to DeAndre's character. They're here primarily as an academic and a scholar, and they didn't come to Columbus to get into trouble or cause any harm. They came to Columbus as an academic before all else, and their involvement in the protest at Pride shows not only their mature worldview, but also their commitment to civic involvement. So taking the gun from a police officer goes against the very nature of a peaceful protest. DeAndre did not come there to escalate the violence. They came there to peacefully protest silently.
Okay. Arianna Steele, I want to thank you for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Arianna Steele is a spokesperson for Black Queer Intersectional Columbus. That's a group representing the folks who were arrested protesting at Stonewall Columbus Pride Parade on June 17th. More coming up on the larger issues confronting organizations like Stonewall and the LGBT community when it comes to people of color and trans. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the fallout from the June 17 protest by Black Queer Columbus. Well, it wasn't by them, but it was by Black trans group protesting at the 2017 Stonewall Pride Parade. Columbus police officers arrested four people protesting the recent acquittal of a Minnesota officer who shot and killed Philando Castile last year. The protesters also wanted to raise awareness about, among other things, what they believe is an exclusionary atmosphere at Pride festivals and in LGBT organizations. Joining us now is treasurer of the Stonewall Columbus Board, Rob Podlager. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also Lori Gum, who has resigned as Pride Festival coordinator and program coordinator at Stonewall Columbus. Lori Gum, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Lori, you resigned over how Stonewall responded to this event on June 17th. What's your complaint?
Correct. Well, it was really the lack of, I think, an impactful response. And after 6 days of waiting for that response that I think was adequate, particularly to, a community in pain. And I think this organization, the responsibility of this organization as the largest LGBTQ community organization was to immediately support this community, to comfort this community, to calm this community. And, you know, I think a lot of times there's sort of this sense is that these protesters are this foreign body that infiltrated this parade. They are our community members. And none of that was done. There wasn't any kind of a response that even attempted to do that. And I released a statement myself on Tuesday about what happened. I think there need to be some clarification, actually, of just the facts on the ground. And then waiting, I was talking to the board. I was talking to the executive director. And by Friday morning, I had told them on Thursday, if there wasn't a statement that I felt was really showing that they heard this concern and were willing to act, that I would resign. And I did.
Why not stay and make changes from within?
Truthfully, I was, after 6 days, was not seeing any notion of change. I would. I care about this organization. I put my heart and soul. I'm also the program coordinator. Mm-hmm. But it was clear that I was not being listened to as far as trying to tell them the urgency of this and the necessity, the absolute necessity, that I thought it was necessary, that I wanted to really be public about the fact that I disapproved of this and I would no longer be a part of this organization if this was going to be typical of how they respected and addressed this community.
Rob Podlager, treasurer of Stonewall Columbus Board. Stonewall has issued the statement that acknowledges there's a disconnect between the organization and Black gay and lesbian and Black trans members of the community. This has been simmering for a long time. I referred to the 1973 address at the New York Pride Parade at the time that called it a white middle class kind of a country club sort of an atmosphere. And that was back in 1973. Right. It's not the first time the issues come up. So when Lori Gum talks about not dealing with it at the time and waiting so many days to respond, what about that?
So first of all, I want to thank Lori for all of her work. I know we first met back in 2010 when I was on the Pride Committee, and she taught me exactly what I learned and how to make it successful. And she has made it successful over the years. And it's unfortunate, but I respect her as a person and her decision to resign. You know, Stonewall stands for equality, and we stand for everybody within our community. And I think what we heard from the protesters is there is a group that have not felt that they have been heard. So after Pride and the days leading after that, and up until yesterday, the board is working diligently to get the facts, to try to understand exactly what occurred at the protest, why they were protesting, and working with other individuals within the community to learn a little bit more about that.
Well, what about the larger issue? Just real quickly, Lori Gum, did somebody request an opportunity to do this protest at the parade?
No, and I was particularly this year because of the size of the parade. And particularly, I think one of the things we have to remember and isn't being addressed enough is that there are very real world threats out there. For this year, the first time I had to have water walls at all the entrances to the festival so that no one would drive a truck through that. So
that means barrels filled with water.
Barrels filled with water. So, you know, we were dealing with a lot of those. I've been working with CPD, Homeland Security, FBI since December. So I was actually put in the lineup on a golf cart in the parade to particularly be the liaison between CPD and Homeland Security. Should something occur, because the parade the people running the parade actually couldn't be listening on the phone. No, I mean, I heard nothing that this protest was going to happen at all. I'm sure that I would have, to my knowledge, I would have been notified of that. And I did not hear anything from CPD as sort of that liaison during the parade that the protest had happened until afterwards. So, and one of the things I'd like to add too, is that that everyone needs to remember, and this isn't an excuse for Stonewall, but when this was happening, we were in the middle of running a festival, mm-hmm. That 500,000 people, a parade that was coming in. Us just trying to, and myself trying to, you know, we saw the video and ascertained what had happened. When I got the video, I actually went to my executive director who was in COSI, and it took me a half an hour to get through the crowd with a bullhorn to get there. So we were behind the eight ball from the very beginning trying to ascertain what had happened because we were not notified of the protest before. At that time, we weren't exactly sure who the protesters were. They were part of our community or what. And I was not notified at any point by CPD that a protest or during the protest later they came over. A Lieutenant Hassan came over and told me very detailed what they believe had happened.
Rob Podlager, just that overarching issue, though, besides what happened during the parade, the protest and however the Columbus Police Department responded to that, will be addressed going forward. But that larger issue of people feeling excluded from an organization like Stonewall, which was, you know, honestly historically formed, at least in its inception, originally by Black transgender protesters.
Yeah, this is a national issue.
Right.
It's not just a Columbus issue.
Absolutely.
And I think we're seeing it in the week prior to the Columbus Pride. Laura and I were speaking. I was in D.C., so I was part of the National March. And, you know, there is a group of individuals that are impacted with racism, homophobia. They are feeling excluded. In Columbus, they're feeling excluded nationally on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And, you know, this is not just a Stonewall thing. This is a community thing for us to be able to try to work together, to listen, to understand. But what's important is that I want to make sure that we could not rush to judgment because we did not have all the facts. And so we made a statement on Saturday, we made a statement on Sunday, and then we spent that following week really doing the research.
There was confusion about what Stonewall officials meant when they said that they would support the four protesters after the arrest. What was meant at the outset? What changed?
Yeah, and, you know, hindsight is 20/20.
Yeah.
If we're able to go back and be able to be more clear and specific, we would want to be able to do that. First of all, when the incident occurred, we wanted to make sure that the protesters would be able to be connected to legal support when they were over at the jail. So we had an individual go over there to try to make that connection. I think there was miscommunication on the
words
that were used.
Who's going to support?
Right.
Who's going to pay for the legal rep?
Yeah. Okay. So the other piece that was not clear is that as a 501c3, we cannot pay for somebody's legal fees. All right. That probably wasn't necessarily known at that moment to publicly state that. And in the moment, you don't necessarily have to worry about that piece of it because we're worried about other things. We should have come out sooner and let the public know we can't do that. We can lose our 501c3 status. We would lose all of the abilities of the other things that we're trying to do within the community. So going back, looking at that, we would have liked to have been more clear with that.
Yeah. You know, Lori Gum, there is a concern, not just in Columbus, mm-hmm. but across the country, that pride celebrations and parades have become too closely aligned yeah. with law enforcement and corporate sponsors in
Correct.
Particular. The movement started as a protest against institutional discrimination and police brutality. How has the event changed in conjunction with that? I mean, how do you respond to that as the yeah. chief organizer of the event, which is considered one of the most successful
yes.
and biggest in the country?
Yeah. And, you know, I've been with it for 7 years.
Yeah.
I saw it really as a smaller celebration. Like I said, Rob and I were there in the trenches 7 years ago. Here's what I think needs to happen. This community needs to do some soul searching about what kind of pride they want. And that should be a community conversation, particularly with queer people of color, because it costs $400,000 to do this event. You are not going to do an event this size without corporate sponsorship. You are not going to do an event this size without police protection. And, you know, I think I would love to see something like a collaboration with CPD and community policing to do this. But I will tell you, and this is the details I think people need to know, in order to get your parade permit, you have to meet with CPD. They will tell you on a worksheet how many officers, how many cruisers, how many lieutenants, how many sergeants, how much that's going to cost. After I pay them, I get a receipt and I go and I get my parade permit. That receipt is necessary to get a parade permit. So the processes are going to change. It have to change in the city, just permitting processes, because CPD defines that. You have to pay for that. And if you don't, you will not have a parade permit. Now, maybe this goes forward where there's no permit. It is a community protest and people gather and march to City Hall. That may be what Pride is, but I think it's going to be soul searching. But to just say that these things can magically happen
without
money, without security. I mean, really, do we want to bring this many people together in this state of this world? And we're responsible for their safety too. Everybody, black, queer, you know, everyone. We're responsible for everyone's safety. And you know that feeling last year when after Pulse, it was 4 days.
Yeah.
It was a nightmare for 4 days. And like I said, I think our real sin in this community has been when so many of us felt relief when we saw that CPD bike crew pull up. There were some of us that did not feel comfort with that, that felt frightened, that felt rage, and we've forgotten that. And this whole community needs to decide what Pride's going to be next year.
Yeah. Rob,
So I think the initial question was about corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
As the Stonewall marches occurred in protest back many, many years ago, I think we have evolved. There is a time and a place for protesting, and I personally support that. And I know that Stonewall does also. But there's also being an advocate. There is partnering with allies. And yesterday was the 2-year anniversary of marriage. And that's pretty impactful,
mm-hmm.
right? And we wouldn't be there without our neighbors and our friends and our family to support us through that process. And they are the corporations. They are the small businesses. They are the ministers at the church. And I think we have to take a step back and understand that there is money in order for us to be able to push forward our agenda to help all the individuals within our community. And I look at it from the standpoint of we need their support. And going through the parade myself, past 2 years, I've led with the banners. And I have felt some fear front and center, not really quite sure. You know, you're pretty there. But the sense of pride to do that walking hand in hand with my husband says a lot.
It is pride. It's not protest.
Yeah. Well, the very word pride implies protest historically. So it's a loaded word. It's
yeah.
a loaded word with a big history. And that's where we are right now with a lot of words and language that are loaded. I'd like to add something to that Rob said, and he's absolutely correct. I think one of the things we need to remember about the corporate presence in the parade is that for a long time, we couldn't be out at work.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these companies that are now in, it started with very courageous employee resource groups within those corporations that forced the Huntingtons and the AEPs to develop particularly hiring policies. This year, I think you know you could not march in the parade unless you had an anti-discrimination policy. That was our new rule. So on one hand, we have the sort of corporate sponsorship, but at the same time, those people marching in the parade with their company's T-shirt on actually represents progress itself. And the progress that this community has wrested from this city, from these corporations, this community has made this the most progressive city, one of the most progressive cities in the Midwest. This community did that. And to in any way negate that progress just in the name of throwing it all away, I don't think is the best direction.
So, Rob Podlager, then, how does then a group like this, you know, different groups, how do they get lost in this mix?
I think that there are a lot of layers for some individuals. And I think that as organizations, we have to be able to open our eyes to a different lens, maybe a lens that we don't look through, to be able to start including those individuals. You know, I have friends that are African-American, lesbian, business owners, mothers, all of these different things, and they are, what are they first? Which one do they come first? Are they a lesbian first? Or are they an African-American first? Transgender going through the same thing. I think we as a community have to open up our eyes. If the protest started back in the late 60s, early 70s about this for the unknown, the people that felt that they weren't being listened to, loud and clear, there are people in the city now that are listening to this so we can understand. And that's how we'll figure this out together. People may not agree with what Stonewall has done over the past 10 days. Maybe we didn't, in some people's mind, communicate quick enough. But what we have to do is think about going in the future, hand in hand, in order to be able to resolve this, as opposed to pitting against each other. I think now is the point that we really want to be able to hold hands and try to figure this out with those individuals that do feel excluded.
Lori Gum?
I think it's important that we can't just listen. People of color need to be put in the positions
yep.
Of making these decisions. People of color, queer people of color need to be put right now in the decision-making process, defining the very agenda of this conversation at Stonewall and this entire community.
Yep.
Listening's great. That's great. That needs to happen. But this really needs to be a practical inclusion at now.
I would agree. I'd clarify yeah. what I said. I would totally yeah. agree because it's listening but understanding but having them at the table to help us
decide what questions are going to be asked in the first place.
And the agenda that we have going forward.
Yeah. Lori Gum, former Pride Festival coordinator and program coordinator at Stonewall Columbus, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also Rob Podlager, treasurer of the Stonewall Columbus Board, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, more conversation about this issue, who's in, who's out, who needs to be in on the conversation at Stonewall and other big LGBT groups across the country. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about Pride festivals and parades and how they've changed over time and how new protests are emerging within the LGBT movement, including a protest at the Columbus Pride Parade on June 17th. Four were arrested, all are out on bond. They were protesting the recent acquittal of a Minnesota officer who shot and killed Philando Castile last year. The protesters also wanted to raise awareness about, among other things, what they believe is an exclusionary atmosphere at Pride festivals and within the LGBT community. The first Pride was the Stonewall Rebellion on June 28, 1969. It was led by trans women of color against police harassment and brutality. We look back and ahead now. Joining us is Program Supervisor for the Greater Columbus Empowerment Center, Rick Elliott Davis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to
be here. Also, historian and author Kevin Mumford. He teaches history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he's author of the 2016 book, Not Straight, Not White, Black Gay Men from the March on Washington to the AIDS Crisis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Your book recounts the history of black gay men from the 1950s to the 1990s. Let's start with the 1950s and 60s. How did they fit or not in the civil rights movement?
Well, there's two answers. One is that if you look in black popular culture in the 1950s and early 1960s, there's a lot of representation of, for example, black drag queens. There's a way in which they fit into popular entertainment, and there was a certain kind of admiration for their entertainment and their transgressiveness. On the other hand, there are figures like Bayard Rustin, who was one of the key tacticians behind the civil rights movement, who was in effect teaching Martin Luther King about nonviolent tactics. However, in 1953, Rustin had been arrested for a morals charge. He was caught in the back seat of a car in Los Angeles with two other men. And that fact had always hindered him. And so he was often pushed to the sidelines of the movement. And when other members of the civil rights movement made a big deal of his arrest, he offered his resignation to Martin Luther King, and King accepted it. So there are two sides. There's a way in which the civil rights movement couldn't afford to have exposure around the issue of homosexuality.
I mean, Bayard Rustin, it should be noted. I mean, he helped organize the March on Washington.
Absolutely.
I mean, he was key.
He was absolutely key. But it's interesting that if you look for posters advertising who is going to speak at the movement, who organized the movement, it's A. Philip Randolph. Rustin has been pushed to the side. So he really, imagine if you are the key organizer of a movement and the day after it, you don't have a position. Nobody wants to hire you. A. Philip Randolph essentially constructs a kind of institute for Randolph to operate in. So there was a way in which he was still vulnerable and there was still not enough strength or advocacy around gay rights at that moment in time.
Kevin Mumford, where did, and I'm going to use the word stereotype because I know it's not universally true, but, you know, there's always a kernel of truth in a stereotype, the homophobia within the black community, that larger community. And can you tell me what you understand about the seeds of that and also how that's affected the trajectory of gay black men in the United States?
Right. Well, there are different opinions on this. One point is that the Black community increasingly came under pressure around the family and juvenile delinquency and criminality, right, going into the late 1960s. And there was a great deal of social science and discussion about the ghetto. And all of that, I think, led to a certain kind of defensiveness amongst Black leaders and increasingly African-American social scientists who wanted to sort of defend the normalcy of African-American culture. And in that moment, they deny homosexuality. There's a kind of a real sensitivity about that in African-American
discourse. Is it like we just don't need this hassle too?
Right. I think exactly. And it's interesting because it's happening at the same time that there's greater acceptance among white social scientists and studiers, people that study sexuality, that homosexuality is a normal role, right? That it's not entirely pathological. So there's a kind of divergence by the late 1960s and early 1970s, I think.
Rick Elliott Davis, your program supervisor for Greater Columbus Empowerment Center. Why do you even need a Greater Columbus Empowerment Center? It's a separate organization to work on HIV prevention, education, and advocacy for Black and Latino gay men. Why is it necessary to have a separate organization? What's missing in those larger groups?
Sure. So GCMC, or Greater Columbus Empowerment Center, services men of color ages 13 through 29. It's a formerly CDC-funded program that has been in existence
Centers
for about
disease
5
control.
Years. Correct.
Right.
Correct. So the need for a program like this is to offer a safe space to that demographic, to young men of color. They're often a very disenfranchised community, often have no safe spaces to go. Some of the gentlemen that we work with are itinerant couch hoppers, unable to have some normalcy in their life. So to have a program like this and a place for them to go is offering something that is really not found otherwise in the city of Columbus.
Because being gay and being of color, it's a double whammy.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that it's almost like a civil rights issue that you've sort of got a lot of negatives against you. Of course, in the struggle for LGBTQ equality, that's one mark off of something that's a difficulty. And then on top of that, to be a person of color or a young man of color, it's another thing. It's another strike against you, if you will.
And coming from a community that, like I said, stereotypically doesn't embrace it, in fact, rejects it.
Exactly. Exactly. I personally have grown up in communities of faith and the church community, was raised in the church. And it's something that's extremely not just taboo, but it is not a thing. You shouldn't be gay in the African-American church. There are things that you don't want to deal with, that the church doesn't want to deal with. And it becomes difficult for persons who do want to have a spiritual or a faith background that they're not able to marry that with their own sexual choices or with their sexuality. So it's not dealt with, and it's something that's pushed to the back burner, which further hurts the people that are just trying to express their faith or express who they are as a person.
Kevin Mumford, rejection by communities of faith, rejection of LGBTQ, that's not exclusive to the Black church community, but it's been dealt with differently. What's the difference? Why this enduring sense of and feeling of rejection, where in other communities, I guess the Catholic Church rejects it, all things being equal, but there's not the same kind of diminution?
It's interesting. One of the big surprises in writing this book was how central the Black church was to my study. I mean, it shouldn't surprise me as a historian of African-American culture, because going back into slavery, the church has been crucial, and obviously in the civil rights movement as an institutional meeting place and a source of leadership. But really, a number of black gay men grappled with their place in the church and sought out faith, even to a greater extent, I think, than white gay men going back to Stonewall. One figure that I found was a man named Brother Grant Michael Fitzgerald, who was part of a Catholic order in Milwaukee called the Salvatorians. And in the early 1970s, during gay liberation, he fought very hard for a place for outreach to the gay and lesbian laity. He lost, but there was this moment in which the Catholic Church was opening and considering and learning about gay and lesbian life, similar to what we've seen recently with the Archbishop of Newark reaching out to gays and lesbians. And also later, another figure, James Tinney, who was a professor at Howard University, a black gay man, and he was a leading authority of the Pentecostal Church, which is a very sort of orthodox religious order, very strict. But he had found a place in the church until he decided to come out in the Gay Liberation March of 1979. Mm-hmm. And there he was excommunicated. So there's been a long struggle of African Americans, gay men, trying to find a place in the church.
Now, Rick Elliott Davis, going back to what the Greater Columbus Empowerment Center does, you said it's from, you know, youth to 29. What happens to people after they turn 29? I mean, what's the magic there?
Sure. So the center itself, we do cater to that demographic. The center is a drop-in center, so we have available Wi-Fi, computers, PS4, TV, Fire Stick, food, snacks, and things like that on a regular basis. In addition to that, we offer social and educational programming a couple of times a week. So after that 29 age, you're not necessarily kicked out of participating or from participating with the events. It's just that that demographic is one that is struggling in very many ways. The HIV rate of HIV infection in the city of Columbus is extremely high.
Right.
The Center for Disease Controls has predicted that black men, one out of two black men by the age of 30 or in their lifetime will become infected with HIV. So to have a place that is in prevention and intending to take away or eliminate those statistics, it's the reason why we're there. And after that age of 29, you're still able to be a part of the events. It's just there's a core group that is up to that age 29.
Do you ever envision a time when the Greater Columbus Empowerment Center won't be necessary, where larger groups will embrace the mission, where there won't be the homophobia, there won't be the stigma associated?
It's a hope. It's something that I think we all hope for, that stigma will be erased or eliminated, and that we're able to progress beyond the right now and racism and homophobia. And again, going back to the earlier statement of these negatives and these strikes that you have against you, I don't want GCMC to go away. As a matter of fact, after the end of our program funding from the Centers of Disease Control, we made a plea to Equitas Health, our parent organization, to continue the programming because there is a need for it. And honestly, in the city of Columbus, there is not a similar program with this safe space. Hopefully, yes, in the future, there will be larger programs and programming that will not take away from what GCMC is doing, but add to it. So there are other resources in the community, and there are safe spaces for people to go, people of color to go.
Rick Elliott Davis, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
Also, Kevin Mumford, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Kevin Mumford, history professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and author of the 2016 book, Not Straight, Not White, Black Gay Men from the March on Washington to the AIDS Crisis. Also, Rick Elliott Davis, program supervisor for Greater Columbus Empowerment Center. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.